Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. We'll be doing a couple things on Change Surfer Radio today. I'll be playing the tail end of an interview that I conducted with John Smart. He's a futurist out in California and the founder and chair of the Accelerating Studies Foundation. And I'll be speaking with Ramez Nam, the author of More Than Human. He looks at human enhancement technologies. And then we'll be talking about orgasms and food. So stay tuned for an exciting Change Surfer Radio. So this is the tail end of our interview with John Smart, who's the founder and director of the Acceleration Studies Foundation and one of the leading futurist thinkers about what we call the singularity, or the notion of a rapid, sudden transformation on a global scale caused by technological acceleration.
I think it's going to be much more of a fishbowl world, and you will see the individuals. What I've just described is actually kind of summarized in the Pentagon's new map, Thomas Barnett's book about the military policy of the 21st century. He says that there's a connected core, which is most of the planet right now, and then there's this disconnected gap. These are individuals that are economically, culturally, and technologically disconnected from the integrated core, you know, the World Trade Organization and OECD and all these groups that are basically playing this strongly non-zero-sum economic game right now. And that gap, he says our goal is to shrink the gap, and we want to put resources into what he calls the seam states around it. And basically, he thinks that ozone hole is going to continue to shrink. And I agree with him. I think it's going to continue to shrink, and it's, you know, the problems of the disconnected gap will continue to be more surmountable the farther we go into the future. But I don't think the gap's going to go away. I think there's still going to be a piece of the remaining gap, because I believe we want a future that I call a both-and future. We don't want an either-or, either world governance or individual self-governance. We don't want a world where either humans or our technologies get smarter. We want a both-and. And let me give you just a few examples of that. I think language is probably the first technology that was very clearly a both-and technology. When we developed it, it vastly improved the intelligence of our global brain, if you will call it that, our emergent society, and it vastly improved our sense of individual consciousness. And I think every new technology that we develop, we have the choice as to whether it will roll out initially as an either-or or a both-and technology. And that's one of the greatest choices that we have in determining the path towards these more accelerated, far more, you know, computationally complex futures that we're moving into. So, you know, the first calculators roll out and kids lose their long division skills. When the first automated highway systems roll out in, you know, 2030 to 2050, I will bet you that people will lose their driving skills. They will not be as good of drivers as you and I are today, because they'll let the system take over more and more of that as they dock in those special, you know, HOV lanes and, you know, let the system drive them from A to Z within the city. But I think that more and more there'll be a social mandate for us to say, we don't want that kind of future. We want a future where not only does society function better, not only does our global governance function better, but our individual ability for self-governance also functions better. Our individual ability to do math in our head, because basic math is useful, not only for counting change, which is going to go away in, you know, 50 years, but for all kinds of basic understandings of the universe around us. So we want to measurably be better at basic math than our grandparents will. And for the last 40 years, studies like Trends in TIMMS, Trends in something in Mathematical, Trends in Mathematics and Science, maybe it's TIMS. For the last 40 years, it's clear that the U.S. High school student has been losing math and sciences and some analytical skills. And I think that next generation educational technologies aren't going to allow that. We're going to decide that our children need to have more individual capacity, not exponentially more, but measurably more than our parents did, and society's got to have more. So that's my strongest argument for why global governance, even though it'll be tremendously more important, it's never going to be the whole share of the pie. You know, I could buy that it'll be 80%, but I can't buy that it's going to be 100%.
Well, I'll take the 80%. That would satisfy me.
Me too.
And I do see, as you point to, I think that there are going to be significant synergies between global governance, making the tools and the benefits of modern society available to everyone,
yep,
and the flowering of individual intelligence.
Absolutely.
We're going to have you back to talk more about that. I've been talking with John Smart. He's the founder and president of Acceleration Studies Foundation at accelerating.org. He's the co-producer of the Accelerating Change Conferences, which is being held this year, September 16 to 18, at Stanford University, and you can find out about that at accelerating.org. And you can read his personal website at accelerationwatch.com. Thanks so much for joining us, John.
That's been great. Thank you.
I'm speaking with Ramez Nam again. He's been a former guest on this show. He's the author of More Than Human, which is on your bookshelves and in bookstores today. Welcome, Ramez.
Thanks, James.
You're reviewed in the New York Times today, and as we said before we came on the air, it's not that great a review, but we'll take anything we can get in the New York Times, right?
That's right. It's pretty horrible, but bad PR is still PR.
So More Than Human is about advances in technological enhancement of the human body, all kinds of advances, and it concludes with wiring people's heads together in a giant info web around the world, a scenario that I've been pointing many people to as one of the more attractive depictions of that that endpoint or that way station on our way to something even better. So you've been thinking recently, I understand, about the anxieties that people have about the future, and Joel Garreau's book, Radical Evolution, which has also come out recently, talks a lot about that as the hell scenario, and we talked to him, interviewed him recently on this show. So tell us, what are your thoughts about why people have these anxieties about the future, and how we need to address those anxieties?
Well, you know, I think some of it may actually be evolved into us. There's an argument, I don't know who the source of this is, but I've seen it repeated several times, that many of our disgust reactions to various sorts of biological things, waste products and so on, relate to the fact that those were disease vectors, are disease vectors, but certainly were historically. When we see blood or sewage or bodily waste, we have this built-in biologically encoded revulsion to them. And I think that makes people very suspicious of biotechnology in particular until it gets to the point of utility to them.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I talk about the ideas of ritual pollution in my book, in Citizen Cyborg, and the ideas that of things that fall between the cracks of our cognitive categories, that we have a world in which something's either A or B, and when something's kind of A-ish and B-ish, it freaks us out. But I think yours is more grounded in kind of evolutionary notions, that that all of our ritual pollution notions must have some kind of evolutionary explanation.
They don't necessarily all have to. I think at least some of them do. I think that's why people don't seem to get as scared about advances in computers, for instance, as they do about advances in gene therapy or genetic engineering or stem cells.
Well, I think you're right, except that when there are certainly interstices of where that do freak people out, when somebody has a machine sticking out of the side of their head, and the kind of scenarios that you describe in your book, where machines take up residence inside one's head. I'm reading right now a book that I'm sure is a scenario that would freak most people out. It's by the wonderful feminist science fiction author Joan Slonczewski, who's also a biology professor. And she wrote this book, Brain Plague, about the notion that people might have civilizations of millions of microbe-sized sentient beings who have their own little civilizations inside your own head, kind of give as advisors to you, and that would treat you like a god. I'm sure most people would be very, very uncomfortable with that notion. And but, of course, I guess that's biotechnology. I mean, in some sense, this is all going to be a moot point, isn't it, Mez, because the bio and the nano and the cyber is all going to merge.
Yeah, I think it's heading in that direction. And I also think that when technologies get to the point of being useful to people and affordable and safe, people start to get over their qualms. People don't really have qualms about pacemakers, even though that is this implantation of this mechanical thing in your body, or the birth control pill, or these days, in vitro fertilization.
Let's talk about zombie dogs. That was one of the articles that came out this last week that caught your eye and my eye. What was the zombie dog experiment about?
It was about a way to put animals into something like suspended animation, a state where their bodily functions were slowed or stopped, and they were much less susceptible to kind of degradation or harm if they were injured. Or I think the particular use people were looking at in this case was a way to make open-heart surgeries or other surgeries that risked the patient's life because of the surgery itself safer by almost shutting down the body entirely.
And also suspended animation was in the news this week.
Yeah, related. There's been a few studies on that have come out recently. One was in Scientific American last week, where by administering very small quantities of a gas, I think cyanide, hexafluoride, to animals, they could shut down the animal's bodily functions. And the pitch there was, hey, this is a way to save people in the case of trauma. If someone's been in a car accident or a soldier on a battlefield, they could put a mask over them, pump in some of this gas, and the person would drop into this very low metabolic state and could be kept stable for longer until they could get to a hospital or someplace else.
This is interesting. I mean, on the one hand, you have the depiction of this as a life-saving therapy for our heroes in the battlefield. On the other hand, you have the depiction of these experiments as zombification or something like that. And it reminds me of something I also discuss in my book about how the Christian right and bioconservatives in general have demonized the notion of test tube babies and artificial wombs as harbingers of Brave New World. But at the same time, they are gung-ho for neonatal intensive care units, where you strap these tiny, 20-gram fetoids into, tubes and wires and enormous machines in order to keep them alive, in order to create an artificial womb. On the one hand, you can depict something as a life-saving, wonder therapy, and on the other hand, as a horrific therapy. And people don't seem to get the cognitive dissonance of all that.
It's true. That really is a good point. I think that the press doesn't really help, in that the press's goal is really to sell ads in a certain sense, or to attract attention, and sensational headlines and sensational stories certainly attract a lot more.
You were also saying before we got on the air about the wireless GITV, which I saw on, actually, I subscribed to a blog called MedGadget, which is a fun blog, and they talk a lot about wireless innovations and biomonitoring, the vest that people can wear, which monitors all their vital signs and uploads your GPS location to an ambulance service if you have a heart attack, or the new Gluco watch, which monitors your blood sugar on a constant basis instead of having to prick yourself and actually measure it, and will warn you when your blood sugar is too low or too high. And your eye was caught by the wireless GITV. Again, most people, the notion of having a little TV going through their GI tract isn't terribly exciting, but it is an enormous innovation. And tell us why.
Well, if you have cysts or ulcers or so on, and you need to go in to see a physician, and they want to find out what's going on inside of you, this is a lot less invasive, a lot less intrusive than other medical techniques they have right now. So you may not appreciate this until you really need it, but then you will appreciate it, I think.
Well, I recently had a, I forget what they call it, but I had an endoscopy done to check my colon out, and it's not a very pleasant procedure. It took an entire day out of my life, and it left me rather sore, I have to say.
Yeah, I think most people would rather swallow a pill than go through like a colonoscopy, for instance.
And that was it, a colonoscopy. Well, how's the selling of your book going? I mean, you're wandering around there in the 1,000 to 10,000 range of the Amazon sales list, which is about 30,000 above where I am. And so it seems like you're doing pretty well. And are you getting lots of press coverage? Is the excitement about human enhancement what you had expected?
It's really, I'm very pleased. Like you, this is my first book, so I didn't know what to expect at all. And I've been pleased to get coverage in kind of all sorts of media, in Tote New Reader with you, in the LA Times and Business Week, now in the New York Times. It's really hard to say what actually happens with book sales. This seems like a fairly opaque industry as far as getting real metrics of what's going on. But I'd say the reception has been pretty positive.
I think we should both do audiobooks of our books, because I've been listening to a lot of audiobooks recently. I think that's probably the wave of the future. Literacy is on its way out. We should all just do audio.
Well, I don't know how, what your commute is like, but my commute is long enough that audiobooks are very appealing.
Well, Mez, this is something I think we should do on a more regular basis, because you have made yourself into an expert on a field that is central to this show, so let's check back.
Well, I'd love to.
Okay, great. So I've been speaking with Mez Ramez Nam. He's the author of More Than Human, which is out and something that you should buy and read. Thanks for joining us today, Mez.
Thank you.
This is a summary of a news article from betterhumans.com. You can find that at betterhumans.com. Orgasm switches off parts of women's brain. If you're a Seinfeld fan, you'll remember the abstinence episode where George stops having sex and gets smarter, while Elaine abstains and becomes dumber. Although you can't put much scientific reliance on a Seinfeld episode, researchers at the University of Groningen have discovered that sex does affect the female brain. Unlike Elaine, who lost brain power when she stopped having sex, the team found that several areas of a woman's brain turn off during orgasm. The researchers gathered 13 healthy women and asked them to lie with their heads in a PET scanner while they were being sexually stimulated. The PET scan revealed that as the women were turned on, activity increased in the somatosensory cortex, the part of the brain that controls senses. However, activity dramatically dropped in the amygdala and hippocampus, the areas associated with alertness and anxiety. The researchers believe that the drop in activity in certain parts of the brain has an evolutionary function. Everyone knows that women can't have sex if they're anxious. So as a woman becomes aroused, this part of the brain becomes inactive, letting the instinct to reproduce take over. A similar study has already been performed on men, however. Their brains had far less deactivation. Next up, the team hoped to look at what happens to the brain immediately following an orgasm. Research was reported in the European Society of Human Reproduction and Embryology annual meeting minutes. One of the issues that's often puzzled me is how and when we should put different kinds of human enhancement technologies, things which are not clearly therapeutic or even therapeutic treatments, into the plan, when they should be covered by health insurance or when Medicaid or Medicare should cover them. And here's an argument from Sweden for why in vitro fertilization should be covered by a national health service. So the article is again from Better Humans. IVF kids make economic sense. The potential benefit that in vitro fertilization children bring to society far outweighs the cost of producing them, according to a Swedish scientist. Maria Granberg of Fertilitetscentrum in Gothenburg, Sweden, says that while the total cost of IVF financed by healthcare systems in Nordic countries has increased over the last few years, it is still highly profitable to society. At a time when politicians discuss how to encourage couples to have more children due to a falling population in the Western world, it is extraordinary that the chronic disease infertility should not be paid for by public health systems, she says. Granberg and colleagues looked at assisted reproduction in Nordic countries in 2002 and found that fertility treatments had increased substantially over the last 8 years. Amidst concerns over public funding of fertility treatments, the researchers found that supporting them is a worthy investment. IVF took up only 0.18% of all public healthcare expenditure in Nordic countries in 2002, an increase of 0.05% over the cost in 1994, says Granberg. However, according to official figures from Sweden, the value of a human life is 2 million krona. The cost to society per child, healthcare, school, etc., is 200,000 krona. If you add to this the IVF production cost of 22 1,000 krona per child and subtract this from the figure for the value of human life, you'll see that IVF is not just valuable for people suffering from infertility, but that it is clearly profitable for society as a whole. And I think that's a wonderful way to look at that. And that's, again, from the annual proceedings of the European Society for Human Reproduction and Embryology. Now, we have two food-related items this week. One is eating genes may beat viral vectors. Pill prompts body to produce proteins that could treat diseases such as diabetes. Doctors have discovered a way to deliver genes in pill form. The genes then become incorporated into cells in the lining of the stomach, producing needed proteins such as insulin. Such a delivery system is an important development because many biologically active proteins cannot be taken orally as they break down in the stomach. By delivering genes for such proteins into stomach cells with a pill, it is possible to have the body's own cells produce the proteins and release them into the bloodstream, possibly eliminating the need for injections to treat such chronic conditions as diabetes. While so far there have only been tests in rodents, theoretically the technique should prove safer than other methods of delivering genes, such as using viral vectors. Unlike with viral vectors, there appears to be little danger of genes going to places that they weren't meant to go, since the stomach lining is replaced every few days. The development was reported in the Wall Street Journal. A second food-related piece this week in BetterHumans.com is Nanofoods on the Horizon, Tiny Microbe-Detecting Diagnostics, Expanded Nutrition, Just Two Possibilities. Researchers at Wageningen University are working on food processing techniques that incorporate nanotechnology in a new field dubbed nanofood. Selling it to the public might be of maximum significance. Franz Kompeters, program manager of biotechnology at Wageningen, says, "Consumer acceptance and how they view nanotechnology in food really needs attention. We do not want to end up in the GMO or genetically modified organisms situation. We have to be honest and truthful so that the consumer can balance the risks and benefits of nanofoods. During food production, nanotechnology could be used in several ways. On the processing line, for example, tiny sensors could perform diagnostics for detecting harmful microbes that could interfere with the longevity of food on the shelves. Nanotechnology could also be used to add functionality to foods. For example, food is used as a source of nutrition and energy for building and replenishing the body. Using nanotechnology, food could also be used to carry medicines and nutritional supplements via nanoparticles. These nanoparticles could target specific locations within the body to deliver medications. The food industry has been slow about being future-oriented, and there's much angst about scientists interfering with the production of food. Nanofoods just might trigger an anti-tech outcry, much like the robust cry against bioengineered food. On the other hand, if nanofoods were primarily used as nutritional supplements and for the delivery of medications, they might catch on. In closing, I want to read a little bit of an essay by Bertel Ullman, a leading Marxist scholar, that was published in the Monthly Review, and it's online at monthlyreview.org. The essay is "The Utopian Vision of the Future, Then and Now, a Marxist Critique." Oscar Wilde said that any map that doesn't have utopia on it is not worth looking at. There are a few quotes I've cited as often or with as much pleasure as this one. Yet there is something in the sweeping nature of the claim that has often left me unsatisfied. In examining utopian thinking, I will also try to distinguish what is valid and useful in Wilde's claim from what is not. The confusion surrounding our topic is due largely to the conflation of three distinct elements: having a vision of the future, realizable or not, the impulse to speculate about the future using one's hopes, wishes, wants, and dreams, and the construction of one's vision out of just such materials. It is the latter that is the chief characteristic of utopian thinking. We have already indicated that virtually everyone who voices their dissatisfaction with the status quo has a vision of the future that differs in at least some respects from the present. Certainly, this is true of Marx, whose vision is far more complete and systematic than even most of his followers realize. The impulse to speculate about the future is even more widespread. Hoping, after all, is natural, as is wishing, wanting, dreaming, including daydreaming, anticipating, and fantasizing. We've all engaged in these activities. Some have even let them run unchecked. Some have shared them with others. Some groups in the population, usually subaltern ones, have done more of it, and some societies and ages in history have been particularly marked by it. The Marxist philosopher Ernst Bloch wrote a 3-volume work cataloging such human qualities, trying to free them from the self-delusion and escapism that all too often accompany them. even that consummate realist Lenin can be found approving of daydreaming if the dreams are based on objective reality and one accepts the responsibility for realizing them. There is, without any doubt, the motivation to achieve a better, happier, more secure, and more fulfilling life in all of us, and our imagination has a role to play both in helping us clarify what this is and in stimulating us to act upon it. To this extent, at least, the roots of the emancipatory project can be said to exist within human nature itself. While everyone has utopian impulses, however, only some of us use them as the raw material for constructing their vision of the future. Only some, therefore, qualify as utopian thinkers. Furthermore, wishing for a better future, speculating what this might consist of, is not always and everywhere progressive or even political. Capitalism, after all, has proven very effective in co-opting free-floating utopian impulses. Fashion, for example, is but one example of how our desires for happiness, beauty, and community are cynically manipulated and turned into a means for enriching the few. Lotteries, rock concerts, and mass spectator sports are others. Given forms that are sufficiently distant from the main battlegrounds of the class struggle, even the most radical impulses can be rendered safe for the status quo. So who are the utopians? Well, three groups deserve this name. First and foremost, there are the creators who set down, often in considerable detail, the vision of an ideal society that they captured in their mind's eye. The contents of these ideals vary a great deal, as do the proportion of fact to fantasy, but the brotherhood of man, equality between the sexes, sharing of most earthly goods, checks against tyranny, and an emphasis on education as the chief means of producing good human beings, appear often enough for these utopian visions to have been a major springboard for all socialist thinking that came afterwards. Whether a particular ideal was meant as a blueprint from which a new society or world was to be constructed, or as a standard from which existing institutions could be judged, or simply as an aid to philosophical speculation, or some combination of these, is not, in the last analysis, as important as the central lesson set up in all utopias, which is that society is a product of human beings, and that if they don't like the one that they're living in, they can remake it in a world where most people have always taken their society as a given. What an extraordinary impetus this must have been to think critically and to act. Skipping across Ullman's essay then focuses on the many, many faults that utopian thinkers have had in terms of articulating and mobilizing for their visions. And I'm going to skip to his conclusion, some of the final paragraphs of his essay. The same dismissal of present realities in constructing their vision of the future leaves utopians without an adequate grasp of who is likely to favor their project and who is not. Since life in their ideal society would satisfy everyone, it seems to follow that everyone should be in favor of it. And as the intelligence required to understand how the utopian ideal works is equally distributed throughout the population, there is no reason to single out any section or class of people for their appeal. Saint-Simon, for example, wrote to Napoleon for help. Fourier advertised in newspapers for capitalist benefactors, and Owen petitioned the English Parliament. And many modern-day utopians continue to make similar appeals to the rich and powerful in our society, who are in a position to make a difference. Sometimes it even works a little bit, for there are very few wealthy radicals. And that was a very brief section of The Utopian Vision of the Future, Then and Now, a Marxist Critique by Bertel Ullman in the monthlyreview.org, and it's an essay that I recommend for all of those at all interested in Marx's contribution to our thinking about utopian futures. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my change surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative cyborg democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the Infos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.